This is the Senate Judiciary Committee meeting, January 21st, 1977, room 346, at 1 o'clock. Providing for a guarantee association for property and casualty insurance, and the intention was, when the bill was passed, to exclude that line of casualty insurance known as credit insurance, which is a bad debt insurance that merchants.
How do we know that? How do we know that was the intention? What session was this passed at?
I'll have to look. I think 1971, Senator, and I referred to the model bill promulgated by the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, where the expression is credit insurance. And there is some confusion among people sometimes when you refer to credit insurance. They think you are talking about credit life and credit health insurance, which is another matter. In further explanation, the phrase, the term life insurance and health insurance on line 11 and 12 include credit life and credit health insurance, and so the reference to them in this bill, as it now is in the law, was redundant and had the wrongful effect of not excluding what is properly called credit insurance, bad debt insurance. So this. It did the wrong thing, and this is simply a correction. I've explained that to the several lobbyists for the insurance industry, and I think that they concur that the correction is the proper one.
So you're saying that credit life is included, so these are exceptions to the...
These are exceptions. Credit life and credit health are already included. Exceptions under the reference to life and health insurance, since they are just subclasses of life and health insurance.
Senator Brown.
Just a matter of interest, did this error have its origin in
proposal by the uniform commissioners here in the state, or was this error inflicted on the statute by the federal legislature?
I think the error was the fault of the insurance commissioner who proposed the legislation in the first place.
Right.
Now, on this general subject, in the sense we have this, let me, I think, Madam Chairman, this might be a good bill to do something about this problem that I'll elaborate on for a moment. If the problem was solved, so I want to make that clear, that this does not involve any benefit to me personally, this seems to me, or to my client, because we got the problem solved without the amendments that should be made. But under the guarantee fund, I think it was sloppily drafted in other ways, there's a provision where the guarantee fund steps in the event of the insolvency of an insurance company. In this particular case, the way I got into this, there was a question, it was involved in uninsured motorist claim by my client whose insurance company had gone bankrupt. Now, the uninsured motorist, while a nice person, refused to say or give anything in writing whether or not he was insured. All right. So, I wanted to take his deposition. And since the guarantee life was standing in the place of the insolvent insurance company, I wanted to serve a notice upon the guarantee life so that they would, if any evidence relating to whether or not this guy had insurance would be admissible against them in an arbitration or litigation to be binding upon them. And so I tried to figure out how to serve them. And I'll tell you, there ain't no way to serve them. And there ought to be. And I think a very simple amendment, it would seem simple to me. And of course, there's the argument about what are you going to serve them for. Well, that's irrelevant. There are reasons why you should be able to serve the guarantee fund. And I would suggest that we include an amendment to provide that service upon the guarantee fund should be accomplished by serving the insurance commissioner. And we do this in some other things. I don't remember, in the out-of-state insurance companies and all that sort of thing. And we provide a simple method. Now, he'd know who to give the papers to after that. We simply provide in this act service of any paper in the absence of, or maybe we should say, either they have to designate an agent for service who would accept anything and everything, or if they don't do that, provide for service upon the insurance commissioner. Now, that's right. I don't know if I talked with you about this. I talked to about everybody else in your office. Never got it solved. The guy came in finally after going to legal aid and signed a statement saying that he didn't have any insurance. So we got it all solved. But that amendment ought to be made. And this seems to be the bill to do it in. So could we...
Is that a question? Or?
I would request, Madam Chairman, and I don't know if you want to see anything. I would request that we have Diane prepare in cooperation with Frank, an amendment to this bill that would provide a method for obtaining service on the guarantee fund.
Any other questions?
The next section of the bill covers about six pages. I think it's one of the longest sections in ORS, and the only changes in this section of ORS are on page 4 and on page 5. The number 24 hours is changed to 72 hours to conform the uninsured motorist provision to the new motor vehicle code. As I understand it, the reporting period under that new law is 72 hours instead of 24. And so under this, the insured would have the longer period now to make the report and still comply with the provisions of his uninsured motorist coverage.
Senator Brown.
Just a general
point of information for the chairman. Is it inappropriate for these bills to be written to indicate the subsection that's being amended without having to repeat the whole section? In other words, here on page 2 in line 14, maybe it should have been written ORS 743.792, and then put whatever the particular subsection that's being amended way over 2 pages later, so we don't. Cost of paper and spending doesn't involve 2.5 pages of absolutely.
May I?
I think that's a legislative problem, not a insurance problem.
I think it is in the statute, at least it in legislative council rules, that you must amend the entire section. You cannot amend less than a section.
You were addressing page 4 and 5?
Yeah. So that's the only change there. And the one other change in the law, two other changes, excuse me. On page 9, section 4 of the bill, amends a section which is part of the series of sections dealing with prohibitions against non-renewal or cancellation of automobile insurance policies in certain instances. And those sections were amended at the 1975 session to correct the problem that has arisen in connection with non-renewals. And it was inadvertently omitted, the correction to this last section, 743.930. The non-renewal information or reference should have been added at that time when the other sections were amended, and it was not.
Well.
And so that is the reason for the addition of the words or non-renewal in section 4 of the bill on page 9.
Ms. Godwin, Wade and Means said there was a problem with that section.
I think perhaps section 5 is what they were referring to.
Section 5 has a problem with a typo. Section 6 was the one that said there's
a question has been raised with me on section 6. There is a typographical error, too, on line 22. That should read section 6 of this act. That was an error in the draft that was submitted. And one other thing, Madam Chairman, I noticed that this housekeeping bill needs some housekeeping. On line 16, the change that is indicated there should be deleted. Bill, if you would, should be amended to go back to the original language referring to the insurer. It was an error in the drafting there. We thought a correction was needed, but on further reflection, I realized that a correction was not needed, that the term should be insurer.
Sorry?
Right.
What is the problem with section?
I think
Diana, I'm sorry. What is the problem with section 6?
That there's an accounting problem, as I understand it, with the executive department. That the insurance division is a general fund agency with all receipts deposited as revenue to the general fund, and establishment of this account under section 6 would provide an exception in the manner in which this agency is budgeted, and that would require additional accounting by the state treasurer and the executive department with no apparent benefit, except an attempt to provide this department with funds limited in the budget.
I can explain without taking vigorous exception to what the executive department has recommended. We have a problem. We get requests which are hard to predict for information out of our computer system, and we have for some period of time we treated the revenue that we received from the sale of that information as an offset to our expenditures. It seemed like a very tidy way to do it, but the accounting division does not like that method of handling revenue. And so it was suggested to us by our own Commerce Department accounting people that we should ask the legislature for this revolving fund authority. I was told yesterday that the executive department, as a general principle, does not like revolving fund authorities, and so they have asked for this to be deleted. It's not a matter of great financial consequence. About $5,000 every biennium would be involved, and theoretically we could ask for an increased appropriation to cover that, but we thought it was a good way to handle it, but if the boss doesn't think so, that's okay with us.
Thank you very much. Does anyone else want to testify on Senate Bill 62? Senate Bill 96. Charlie?
I'm the director of the Department of General Services. We have before you this afternoon a series of my staff refers to as housekeeping bills. Some of them seem to be smaller pieces of housekeeping than others. The first one is designed to remove statutory references relating to penalties where the things that the penalties run for were removed by the legislature.
Scanlon, have you checked out the references? Yes, I have. And they all appear to be fact of things. Any questions about Senate Bill 96? Hearing none, we'll turn to Senate Bill 130.
Senate Bill 130 adds to the general ability of the Department of General Services under the capital construction account. At the present time, we're allowed to construct, improve, remove, repair, do all sorts of things to buildings under the capital construction account, but for some reason, and we can't find any research that indicates the reason, we're not allowed to purchase existing buildings. There have been a couple of times when it would have been to a decided advantage of the state to be existing buildings that come on the market, and that we would have had money in the capital construction account to purchase it from the capital construction account if we had that legislative authorization. All the controls on the capital construction account that are in place would apply to this just as well as if we wanted to spend, say, $500,000 to build a building. We'd have the same controls and spend $500,000 to construct it. Or I guess the other way around, buy rather than construct. And there are buildings that come on the market from time to time, and it would be advisable to select that fund.
Senator Smith. I have an obvious question. If this bill passed, would it mean that you could buy the Capitol Wing?
Never occurred to me that that would be a problem.
We have a little trouble financing it, and it is an existing building.
Definitely is an existing building.
Certainly, I don't know who owns it. We haven't paid for it.
I have always had the faith, and my name is at the bottom of the contract, by the way, that somehow the legislature would find the money to pay for it. I presume I under this fund at the present time, I could have, if I had $14 million in capital construction fund, have found the money to build the wing. And therefore, if this authorization existed and they were built, I guess I would have the money to purchase them, except I'd be purchasing them.
Well, the reason that I'm dubious, and I'm not trying to be smart, but the original authorization did come down, as I recall, into the Department of Commerce, did it not?
Capital wing?
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe so. I arrived on the scene on September 1st of '75, but I don't know.
I think it was in a dollar appropriation. I think the authorization came one way and the method of financing came another.
I arrived to find the wings of fait accompli, but
we have no.
That's something that I clearly
when concerned. I arrived. Well,
the question is moot. I don't think there's that much money in capital construction.
About raising the women.
Well, that refers to the larger question. We just would like to have access to the fund to use it for purchase if we're authorized to. The legislature has never given us any more than $1 limitation on a construction either. We're used to seeking the advice and consent of the legislature before utilizing the capital construction fund. So I presume that you would continue to put in the limitations except for those specific projects authorized at the time.
Further questions?
Oh, there is one other item. We have
I was going to ask a very general question. This whole thing is—I don't know. Is it best to ask him a bunch of questions?
Go ahead. Ask
fellow senators away from the meeting, but don't waste time.
No,
I have to start asking very basic questions, like what the capital construction fund is, and things like that.
A learning process for me too, Senator. It's my first time before this committee and my first time discussing the capital construction project. So we're doing it together. Basically, we have a capital construction fund which is utilized by the Department of General Service to construct, improve, repair, and otherwise do the same sort of things that we do for all sorts of projects for state government. It's also a fund in which occasionally comes gifts, grants, and donations, so I must admit that's my portion of the fund. At the present time, we can utilize that fund when authorized by the legislature in the budget for everything except the purchase of existing buildings. This is the fund, for instance, with which we remodel the Commerce Building. It is the fund from which we will the Commerce Building is part of the Capitol Mall area. The Capitol Mall area is this general area we're in now. We remodel the Commerce Building out of this fund. We will purchase the post office out of this fund again. All these are all done with legislative authorization. The method of legislative control is generally to place a $1 limitation and then have us come in with a specific project. We had no idea in 1975 that the post office would become available. That planning wasn't far enough down in the federal world. They hadn't discussed the matter yet. When it did become available,
charge because the federal government placed a limitation of time.
Yeah. Otherwise, we would have come to the line. We were given so many days.
So what authority did you have to go to the E-Board?
We were requested by the legislative leadership to bring the matter to the E-Board.
If we, how would what you're proposing we do today affect your ability to go to the E-Board in the future?
Not all. It would permit us to use the capital construction, but we're not using the capital construction fund in the case of the post office. But it would permit us to go to either the legislature or the emergency board for the purchase of existing buildings utilizing the capital construction. We can utilize that fund right now to do everything but buy an existing building. We think that it makes sense that if we can build a building in this fund, if the price is better for the state or the location is better, that we ought to be able to also buy an existing building in this fund. That makes sense to us.
Mm-hmm.
That if we can be authorized to spend $500,000 to build a building from the capital construction fund, we ought to be able to spend $5,000 to buy an existing building if one comes on the market. And from time to time in Salem, the general thing that occurs is that people prefer to lease to us, but from time to time we'll find somebody that wants to place a building on the market. And we'd like to have the ability to purchase instead of construct if we can prove the case. So that's all we're asking here in this part, in this particular amendment.
Good.
What would we have to do to make it so you couldn't buy a building or construct buildings between sessions?
I don't know, sir. Oh, they're probably suggesting it, but I prefer to leave the legislative business to the legislature. I don't know, sir.
Well, I would suggest that. Could I suggest that?
Senator
Brown. For what fund does the post office purchase?
I don't know.
What is this capital construction?
I don't remember who was the post office.
Madam Chair.
Senator.
Is there some kind of constitutional limitation regarding the construction of these buildings or the authorization? It seems to me there is.
There's constitutional limitations, to my knowledge, on how long we can lease or how we can obtain money.
Why have we always in the past gone to the FEPA for authorization to build new buildings?
I think what we've done we've had quite a discussion in relation to the building authority, which is said unconstitutional, was for the authorization to raise the money through various means, generally through revenue bonds or construction.
Senator Brown asked the question.
Oh, I
see.
Well, you say you came in January 75?
I arrived in September.
After the housing authority has been established.
Yes.
Well, this housing authority, the problem with the Court of Appeals found with the housing authority, were you working with programs that were part of your expertise would have been involving housing authorities, issuing the bonds and so forth before you came here?
Yes, I've been with two cities, the city of Beaverton in California, the city of Beaverton, Oregon, the city of Burbank in California, both of which had construction projects. Use different methods of financing. In the case of the city of Beaverton, we use tax increment financing under the law here. And in the case of the California city, we have two types. One was a special improvement district called the Mall Improvement District, and the other was general obligation bonding by a vote of the people for specific projects. So the type of bonding proposed under the state building authority was a new one to me. I was one of
didn't accomplish much. We had preliminary talks with people who put together and sell bond issues. That's all that was accomplished before the court passed on the issue.
This was to be a bond issue that wouldn't have obligated people directly. And that was the argument that the use of them was based on.
I'm not too sure what arguments were presented in order to sell the building authority. The building authority would have had the power on its own motion to sell revenue bonds. The revenue would have been, which would be used to construct state buildings. State buildings would then be occupied by state agencies, and the rent from the state agencies would be used to retire the bonds. This is a form of financing that exists, I would guess, in some 10 or 12 states. That's my personal account of it.
But there's a good deal in the literature about it, isn't there?
Yes.
And hasn't it run into legal problems elsewhere?
Yes and no. It depends entirely on how the Constitution of the state is organized. It certainly ran into legal problems in the state of Oregon. It was, turned out, entirely unconstitutional.
And didn't it run into legal, that kind of financing run into problems in New York?
Well,
some housing kind of.
There were a couple of kinds of housing there. There was a higher education bill for higher education dormitory housing that ran into trouble. It's worked well, apparently, in some states and not in others. A great deal depends upon whether you have adequately estimated the revenue flow from the project. And like any other revenue bond, if you have in any way given any but the most conservative estimate of the revenue flow, you will be in trouble.
Aren't these sometimes called un-something kind of bonds?
No, I think, are you thinking of tax anticipation bonds?
No. Wasn't the idea of this kind of bond that you could sell bonds and get money without obligating?
Well, these are not general obligation bonds.
Right.
They would not be a general obligation of the state of Oregon. That is a slightly lesser class in the safety of bonds on the bond market, and your ability to sell them at a low level of interest depends upon the belief on the part of the bond buyer that the revenue will be there.
And doesn't that include a belief that if anything goes wrong, that the government in question will come in and fund the bond?
It's hard to say. The municipal bond market is the most conservative of all investment markets that I know, where a banker is defined as a man who will, you know, lend you $1 million if you can prove you don't need it. A municipal bond buyer is a guy who will lend you $1 million provided you will give him $1 million to hold in his hand. it's the most conservative of all markets, and they do differentiate between, you know, full faith and credit, general obligation bonds, and revenue bonds, which are very close to it. The fact is that the bond history of the state of Oregon is one of the best in the nation. I'm sure they would take into consideration the fact that the state of Oregon would be unlikely to have to allow a default on any of its bonds, whether or not they were general obligation bonds. So I think that has a psychological factor. But anybody purchasing the bonds would be more to look, would look at two things. One is the financial management picture of the state of Oregon, and the other is how the revenue flow is figured. One of our advantages under this would have been that the state, after all, has the power to set the rent on the buildings and has the power to order the tenants into it. This gives us a considerable advantage over someone in the private sector who builds a building and hopes somebody would move in it. In our case, we build a building, we tell people to move in, and we tell them what the rent is. So it did give us an advantage in the market. Whether it's a fair advantage or not, I don't know. It was a tool that was here when I arrived.
Guaranteed 100%
It. We were told that they would have been considered a good investment, and that they probably would have sold within a point or two of general obligation bonds, just because of the nature of our law.
And what is it we're going to build with these?
Nothing now, sir.
What were we going to build?
I believe one of the first ones would have been the structures next door. The Second Amendment within this simply helps cover a gray area by extending the definition of branch office building to include central office quarters outside the city of Salem. The law already says that, and then central office facilities outside of the Capitol Mall area, but still inside the city of Salem. Right now, we have a definition that has office buildings within the mall area defined as one thing. Office buildings outside the city of Salem are branch office buildings, and office buildings located outside the mall but not outside of Salem aren't anything. So we're now making them branch office buildings too. Just to cover a gray area.
Any questions?
One, Madam Chairman. The Capital Planning Commission is very jealous of their opportunity to control all kinds of construction inside the city of Salem. Would this give them the opportunity to also control construction of buildings within the city of Salem outside the mall area?
Only to the extent that they could work at confirmation to the plan which has been adopted. You know, they have one kind of planning responsibility for the two counties. Any state office building that is in an area covered by a state plan would have to conform to the plan and be part of their obligation to see that it was. Their ability to control aesthetics and the like applies only within the mall area, and this would not extend. I am a member of the Capital Planning Commission by statute, but to the best of my knowledge, this does not extend the power of the Capital Planning Commission.
Right,
that's
that. Any further questions? Senate Bill 131.
Bill 131 relates to the way that we enforce parking violations at our facilities and allows us to, under the present law, we don't have the power to properly enforce parking violations adjacent to leased office space. We do when we state-owned office building parking lot, but when it's leased, we're not. And we've had some problems with parking enforcement at those facilities.
Is
that on premises or off premises?
That's on premises. In the parking lots at the facilities where they are leased.
Senator Smith.
What kind of problem?
Well, people come in and park, for instance, in spaces marked for the handicapped, or spaces marked clients or leave their car there, and because of the fact that we're not the owner of the property, under the statute that gives us the power to, number one, write rules, and number two, contract with the local law enforcement agency to issue citations for us, where it's a leased parking space, we don't have the ability to enforce now. And in some cases, a few people become aware of this, and in areas where parking is scarce, they just come in and park in a state lot and smile at it.
Wouldn't the owner of the building have the same authority as anybody else who then could call the local officials and say, look, my lessee is having trouble with parking. Why don't it's part of your job to take care of all of these things?
I don't know if a lessee can contract with a political subdivision in the same way that an agency or officer of the state. The second one would be
the owner.
Yeah, I don't know that the owner. The second one would be that since we're the tenants of the building and we're the
third party. In some cases, the owner maybe is absentee. It's much easier if we just are given the same right in lease space that we have in state-owned space, which is the right to contract with a local law enforcement agency on court.
Well, now, how does a private owner, let's say that I have a an apartment house and I've got a parking lot as part of that, what are my remedies in case some outsider comes in and leaves his car there? What can I do then?
I believe it varies with the individual code where you are. In the city where I was manager, you could post and notify the police, and the police would come and enforce. This relates to the power granted us by the state to go to the police and contract.
This is following Senator Hunt's question. Why, I cannot understand why the state of Oregon, as the lessee, would have less legal rights than I would if I personally leased the same premises.
And I have been informed, and I believe this came out of the city of Eugene, that we were receiving complaints concerning enforcement when we went to enforce, and I think citations were actually issued, and the citations got in court. The attorney for the defendant brought to light the fact that the state agency there did not have authorization to enter into such an agreement with a local law enforcement officer, and therefore the citations were voided. That's my understanding. I'm not a lawyer. The law confuses me a great deal of the time.
Well, Madam Chairman, I think we ought to have a lawyer check into this, because it may not hurt anything to do this, but if we pass it, we ought to do it on its own merit rather than what I suspect might be some erroneous theory of the law.
For office section, which can be handled in the contract.
Fine.
I can't imagine that there's no remedy to have somebody's car towed off or something.
Well, some luck attorney down in Eugene got a hold of it. Got him off.
Dealing with someone else who hadn't dressed it off.
The judge in this case, no doubt.
Case, probably. Never assume a judge knows anything. I think that's
You have the advantage. You're an attorney. You may assume that. I'm a civilian. I always make their right.
Judges, I think, sometimes.
Well, the judges assume they know everything.
And the lawyers know.
Any further questions on 132? Comments? 132.
Relates to the responsibilities of general service to provide supplemental insurance for the protection of state buildings, and contains therein a history of the changes that have taken place in the Restoration Fund, which is a form of self-insurance. Section of my department that administers this section of law believes that it's ambiguous because of the fact that it states that we shall insure, but then follows that with the words as required, and they find this hard to deal with. We do purchase supplemental protection funds in case of catastrophe beyond the restoration fund. The restoration fund at the present time has a considerable reserve in it, but not enough to protect against entirely catastrophic
So I have a little trouble myself. Why is it discretionary? I would think that you would want insurance.
Well, no, as a matter of fact, if we have a restoration fund and then an umbrella over that of a catastrophic disaster insurance policy, then we don't want insurance, we can save money by discontinuing insurance. It's pointed out in there, I asked them to find some savings, and they point out the Board of Higher Education is able to save nearly $100,000 a year because the protection is now available through the restoration fund. And so, but the language here is sort of mandatory permissive language that shall buy insurance in the amounts necessary, and we're not quite sure whether that gives us the freedom. We've interpreted that to mean we don't have to buy insurance in those areas where the Field Restoration Fund adequately covers us, but it's a queasy, it's an interpretation. So the people in my department that are responsible for the administration of the fund prefer to have the language changed to be totally permissive.
I assume that this bill says that if, in your determination, the director must make the decision as to the protection of the value of the building. And you can do that in one of two ways. If the restoration fund doesn't protect the building, this bill says, as originally written, you shall buy fire insurance and other hazard insurance. Is that the way you read it?
Yeah. Yes, sir. We don't think it's covered. We must buy it. They're asking to change it to May. My own feeling is that I can live with the interpretation, but they also know that directors come and go and restoration fund managers stay around for 20 years, and it makes them uncomfortable. My feeling is we're going to under either the shall or may, we will continue to purchase amounts of insurance we feel are needed, but it will be less ambiguous. Shall purchase in such sums as required, and may clearly make it permissive.
They're not careful, you know.
Either way,
some senators aren't careful about how they read. It looks like that you may or may not insure for fire.
The fact is that if I insure improperly under either the present language or the proposed language, my tailor's in a ringer or something happens anyway, and like most bureaucrats, I spend a great deal of time protecting that portion of my anatomy.
Well, I'd rather protect the portion of the anatomy of the director than I would those who are worried about it. Here.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Further questions? Currently, the state restoration fund, are they required? The language of this is to sell and pay out.
I don't know.
One other question. I was checking that. Find out if restoration means 100% restoration, 20%. What does it mean? How much money is that?
About
10. It would not restore it. What
do you like restore it, Wayne? I'd
ask for a vote anyway. You'd be right.
Where is the state restoration fund on deposit? Is it growing interest?
Yes.
Invested.
By the trade.
Senate Bill 135
provides another method of financing or acquiring state buildings. It's, by the way, part of a broader picture, and if you were in a position to vote today on this finally to report it out, I would request that you do not. As you know, we had to have our bill in November. Since that time, there's been a number of the legislative fiscal has people working on, the state treasurer and the attorney general have people working on looking at the entire picture of how we finance public buildings and fill the vacuum created by the court's opinion on the building authority.
this would simply be one other way that we might finance. At the present time, we can lease and we can sign rental agreements. This would allow us also to lease with option to purchase. It's my own feeling that before too long, I would hope that there would be submitted by a variety of agencies an omnibus bill on the acquisition of state buildings, because I think that it needs to be done, you know, as a whole and not as little bits and pieces. But this is one of the methods of acquiring buildings that is used both in the private sector and in other jurisdictions. We do not have this power of the law in the state of California and in the state of Washington, for example. This is a fairly common method of the acquisition of buildings. This is a chance to purchase a certain equity, and also in the case where we have specialized buildings that we're leasing, it makes it a little easier for the constructor, because if they are such a specialized building that it's difficult to convert to another use should the state no longer be a tenant at the end of their lease, this method allows him to go ahead and not try to, as he will if we lease a specialized building, he's going to try to get everything back in that lease period. So that's the first thing it does. It authorizes the lease purchase option in addition to lease.
Question.
And the second thing it does is provide a definition of office quarters, which was not in this section. And we felt that definition was new.
Is it in any other section?
I believe that is borrowed from the language used to define office quarters in another section.
Under what?
You say that the specialized use would make it better, because if the person who's building the building, I presume they're also going to be the person who leases the building to the government. Is that correct?
Right. This is our principal way of providing quarters for state agencies outside the capital area, with one or two exceptions, to enter into lease arrangements. And we have the constitutional authority to enter into 20-year leases, but the longest leases I've been able to find are 10 years. In fact, most of them are for 7, some are for 5. Because of the fact that the program needs is so uneven. Great majority of buildings are occupied by human resources. Some of these are specialized buildings. And therefore, when a person is building a specialized building, the building design reflects the needs of the state, and maybe that nobody else has that kind of need.
I followed you that far, but then if you're trying to save money by getting them, by negotiating with them that you may buy it, that's the lease option. But how does that make them willing to lease it for less, as long as it's an option?
In this case, they will tend not to try to recover it as they do now in the first leasing period. In other words, you get a specialized building. The state says we'd like to lease it for 10 years, and you think that building is probably only going to be possibly used by the state. You're going to get everything back in that first 10 years, and nearly everything. Where if the state says we will enter into a lease purchase arrangement with you, so that we're building an equity, then you in effect have them in a closer relationship to you, and you're liable to make the terms of the lease much different and much better and more favorable to the state, because the state, by building an equity, there are two types of lease purchase. One lease purchase arrives at a $0 at the end, $1, and you hand over the $1 to your building. Others rise that you own a percentage of the building. Either way, the state then has a beneficial interest in the building, which it's going to pursue, and the state's not going to go walking away from that interest. If you have a 7-year lease, and as part of that 7-year lease, for instance, you gain a 20% equity in the building, and unlikely that the state will then abandon the lease.
So that has the result of the lease being for a longer period of time actually than is reflected on the
a longer
state.
Period of time, or if it's insurance for a shorter period of time, at least the insurance of the state interest, which is what the landlord is interested in. The problem with our present leasing is that, you know, we arrive at the end of a 5 or 7 or 10 year period, and all we have is the chance to renew a lease and to renegotiate.
Would there be times that you wouldn't want to renew it, it makes it better to lease with an option than to just go ahead and purchase?
There are times when it is better to simply lease. You're unsure of your program.
When's it better to lease, have a lease option, than it is to go ahead and buy?
When you don't have the money. That's entirely correct. When they're just in the capital construction fund for that particular biennium, the money does not exist, the programs have been authorized.
So this is a way to allow us to commit ourselves to future spending without going ahead and buying it now.
Well,
started some program that we're going to be committed to, but we're not paying for it now.
And you would have to be very careful to build in here. I think one of the concerns of the legislature, which I share, is when we get an omnibus bill, we're going to have to build legislative controls in it to make sure that the appropriate method of acquisition is used. For instance, that we purchase when it's advantageous to purchase, that we perhaps enter into lease purchase agreements when the money isn't present at this time, but it's obvious the program will be continued over a period of time, and that we short-term lease the short-term programs, or where we have, for instance, we move people into an office building for 3 years, if we know that the capital construction program which the legislature has authorized calls for the construction of a new office building that they will then move into at the end of the year.
But if you go on a lease option, so you have partly because you don't have money then, aren't you kind of living beyond your means at that time?
Well, you may have a program that you have entered into a 10-year period that you're funding at a certain level, and you want it. Maybe you have revenue coming into that program over that period of time, but you don't have the front money available. And of course,
the reason you want to do this, though, is that you get a better deal out of the builder because he knows that you're committing yourself.
Well, it's one of the reasons, if it's a specialty building. If it's an ordinary office building, the advantage is simply that you build in equity. And it may be that you have a program that the legislature believes will be continued over a period of time. The revenue-related program, and the revenue is going to be coming in over that 10-year period. You may not want to put the construction cost up front. You may want to spread the construction, the cost over a 10-year period in the form of a lease purchase. As I said, it'll be very important that we set in control so that this is used appropriately. The same tool, any acquisition tool, can be inappropriately used. There are times when purchase is appropriate, there are times when lease is appropriate, and purchase would be foolish, there are times when lease purchase is appropriate. This merely adds one more tool to our toolkit for acquiring property for use. One that is generally found in the public sector, elsewhere is found in the private sector. Thank you.
Do we pay an equivalent of property taxes on our city of Salem?
No.
So we rent a building with an option to purchase. Does our rent include, in effect, the property taxes that the owner is paying in the old title?
I don't know whether that portion, that's a good question, whether that portion that we acquire an interest in is an exempt from property tax. I don't know. I do know that when on lease property, we certainly do pay the property tax.
Correct.
Now, I don't know whether the effect of an increasing equity is to shelter that increasing equity from property tax.
Good question.
Bill 136.
This is the last bill, the most complicated one, and one which we've had considerable conversation with other agencies on. We would like at this time for you to discuss the bill, the state that we have been requested by another agency, and I think they are correct to have additional time to work out the definition of what a professional and personal service contract is. Apparently there is considerable variation in what that definition is in statute, and we met the Department of Transportation met with us this morning, and we worked out some of the answers to their questions and segments of the bill, but we were unable to work out their question relating to a common definition of what a professional and personal service contract relating to architectural engineering and related services is. I think they have a right to be concerned because they have other statutory authorizations of their own that seem to at least be in question because of this. So we will be working with them over the next week trying to get a common definition. Basically, we have some responsibility now under the law, and I'd like to expand the definition of services other than personal to include public works projects, except where they relate to the specialized purchases and specialized public works where we already, by statute, do not know. We were given this responsibility, which we share one of the executive departments too, because we are that portion of the state that reviews the architectural drawings and engineering drawings and the like on state buildings, except for a few specialized instances. We've also been given the right to review and approve personal and professional service contracts. That's basically what this does. It also put some of the language about those areas where we should not go into a common subsection.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Is the public works identified any other place? Oh, it's over here. No.
It is.
Well, question, is public works defined anywhere?
Like an elephant. I think I know what it is, and you think you know what it is, but I'm not sure what the law says it is.
Attorney Brown.
Without intending to open a can of worms, I noticed painfully online 2021, it's talking about furnishing the supplies, materials, equipment, and I'm thinking in terms of great colored sofas. Will the contract for those items handle for your?
They were purchased as almost everything in the state except for booze, textbooks, and bridges by the department. I don't care about textbooks and bridges. By the Department of General Services at the request of the legislature.
You have those files with the
state? Oh, yes. They're a matter of public record. I bear none of the glory. My wife won't even let me pick my own shirt, so I don't think I would care to pick furniture for the legislature.
Was it done by bid?
Yes. It's been a very popular item in our office. Lots of folks come over to look at them. They work quite expertise at showing.
Any further questions?
Thank you very much. My first judicial hearing, and I lived through it. I feel much better now.
Mr. Hondra?
with the Department of Higher Education, it might be helpful to start by responding to Senator Smith's question about the definition of public works. The first section of Chapter 279 defines public improvement, and I think it may be more useful to use the term public improvement rather than public works. The reason that I asked to have an opportunity to speak to you was to indicate to you that the statute defines, among the other powers of the Board of Higher Education, the authorization to handle its own physical facilities, and that includes the construction of buildings, the rehabilitation of buildings, master campus planning, and all other kinds of services involving architectural and engineering services. And traditionally, we have contracted for those services directly through my own office. It was therefore with this in mind that it seemed useful to propose to you an amendment to the Senate Bill 136 on page 3, on line 3, and I have copies which I'm glad to distribute to you. I'm a little embarrassed by having to say that I used the word public works instead of public improvement, but
I've learned a little.
I think perhaps with that substitution, the amendment would work equally well, and that is to suggest that the exclusion that is prescribed in line 3 of page 3 for the Department of Higher Education be changed to include public improvement contracts and professional or personal service contracts of the Department of Higher Education as the exclusion, rather than to relate exclusively to academic facilities. To get involved with the definition of what is an academic facility in higher education, we have a great many kinds of facilities, some of which may have indirect relation to academic, but others may not have. We have housing, we have ships, we have clinics and hospitals and hog barns and all kinds of different things, and though they have an indirect relationship to the academic program, I think the use of the term academic facilities may be a bit ambiguous. And for that reason, we would propose the amendment to exclude public improvement contracts and professional and personal service contracts of the Department of Higher Education. I'd be pleased to respond to any questions that which you may have.
Other questions, Mr. Hunter? You've been sitting here. We discussed in an earlier building the parking problem on these premises that you've been making with that.
I picked up the bill today. I am aware that the Board of Higher Education does have special statutes with respect to policing powers on its parking facilities. I do know that there has been demand for special legislation relating to parking facilities. We have, I wish Mr. Branfield were here. He could respond because he's been working closely with that, and I personally have not been. But there are special sections of the statute which deal with the parking problems for the institutions of the state system of higher education.
Right.
Has the Department of Transportation contacted you regarding personal contracts? Do they want an exemption as well, or they don't?
They're in the audience, and I hope that I quote them correctly. I believe we worked out our various problems this morning.
Okay. Well, they're coming later, I'm sorry.
Good question. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Record, I comment at this time.
Yeah,
the proposal. Since I've come here, there's certain things I've become aware of. One is the status of the Department of Higher Education in the world of the state, and I've enjoyed, we actually have diplomatic relations with them, so it's been pleasant to be alive in this dislocation. And there are some times when I am perfectly willing to leave matters concerning facilities to them, particularly in the case of the president and chancellor's house.
On the other hand, we do really believe that there are public improvement contracts with the Department of Higher Education, some of which are not even related to the campuses. We've been crafted with a number of college facilities that are not located on the campus, as a matter of fact, where we think that there is no more reason to exempt them than there is any other state agency. And perhaps what we should look at, if there's going to be a compromise, and our desire to control everything that isn't an academic facility, and I share that with Jack, is the problem of what is an academic in higher education, that perhaps we should relate the exemption to the confines of the various college campuses.
I would respond to that, with your permission, Madam Chairman, that frequently the installations that are off campus are in fact related to the academic program, such as the Institute of Marine Biology, such as the Marine Science Center, such as the Observatory at Pine Mountain, even the Agricultural Experiment Station, even if that has their implications to the academic program. And when the board has been charged with the responsibility of this, it seems that centralization of their planning efforts would be most effectively handled by the board staff rather than to dictate by statute that portions of it would be handled by the Department of General Services. I mean, hasten to add that with respect to a number of projects for bidding, particularly those for rehabilitation, minor repair, and maintenance, and so on, the statutes permit us to go either directly or through the Department of General Services. And our institutions frequently call upon the purchasing office of the Department of General Services for assistance in providing that service, but they also have the option to come through our office.
Question
for
four.
What's the rationale with the public that the higher education is separated off from the rest of
the state? Well, partly, Senator, in that the Ways and Means Committee handled separately the capital construction budget for the Department of Higher Education. And we're already operating within specific statutes relating to capital construction and rehabilitation. And Chapter 351060 prescribes the authority of the board to handle its physical facilities.
So that tells me how, but it doesn't tell me why.
Well, I think it preceded by many generations the existence of the Department of General Services.
And it was the reason why is because they had the political clout at the time that General Services first came in.
I don't believe that it was a matter of clout. I think it was a matter of practical necessity at the time it was started that way.
But when General Services, when this statute was first written, somebody sometimes said, hey, let's leave these guys out. And there was some rationale for doing that.
Senator, perhaps I can give you some insight into my comparatively short-term and unlearned view is all agencies, plus general service and government, can assume that their particular needs are different than anybody else's, and their particular expertise is different and better in any field than anybody else's. And that's just a natural way of human organization. And I think that perhaps this feeling is even deeper and more strongly embodied in higher education. The classic case I've come across is I've been here about 6 months and I was asked to give a speech to faculty club at OSU. And I went down and gave what I thought was a sterling and noble speech. I was really aroused by the fact that I was speaking to an assembly of professors that had been speaking to me for years. And I was very impressed talking about the field. How you get people in government to be responsive. I really felt good about the whole thing. I said, now are there any questions? This little fellow popped up, and I was ready for some real philosophical question. I said, yes. He says, why is it that I can't get a Sherman microscope from General Service? And so I explained to him that we did microscopes. They supply us with specifications, and it's really not my fault that the Japanese underbid the Germans. And I said, how do you prove that the German microscope is better than the Japanese microscope? He says, Vino! We know, sir. That's how we prove. And so I think there's a little of that.
This points to the problem that when the Department of General Services was created, the purchasing of materials and supplies was given to the Department of General Services. It is handled centrally for the state as a whole. It's only in the area of the physical facilities that there has been
continuation. In other words, you're saying that there are two alternatives that make sense. One is to restructure the way it all works, going to Ways and Means, budget hearings, all that kind of stuff, or just exempt you from the building.
We think that the Board of Higher Education policies, which are reviewed constantly by the Ways and Means Committee, are adequate to provide the control of the legislature and for public improvement projects.
I'm curious, is somebody moving in on somebody's turf here just a little bit? Is that what's happening? Well, who's moving in on who? You're moving in on them? Well, actually, it's a review of contracts is what we're trying to get here. And this is something they have previously done for themselves, and it's something we're proposing to do universally throughout the state. Actually, we're not proposing to move in all the way on them anyway. We're proposing an exemption of academic facilities, but as Jack points out, everything they have is academic. That's what they are. And I'm suggesting possible compromise based on geographic facts. Inside the boundaries of the campus, academic, and outside, related to an academic purpose, because we're doing everything we do is, then we can review the service contract.
Well, is this going to be decided, is this something for the judiciary committee to decide, or did I hear you saying that we should not, we should doubt this unless the Ways and Means Committee decides?
Well, I didn't say it quite that way, Senator. What I said was that the proposal that's in this legislation that's before you, Senate Bill 136, would, in effect, place the professional and personal service contracts of the Board of Higher Education, other than for academic facilities, which is an undefined term, as a part of the province of the Department of General Services. My proposal was to exclude, as currently is in effect, all professional and personal service contracts of the Department of Higher Education, since that is being handled by the Board of Higher Education. Now, in the last session, Senator, there was a complete rewrite of Chapter 279 of public contracting law, and various definitions were provided, and various instructions were provided within that amended statute, one of which was in 279051 that public agencies must adopt procedures for the selection and appointment of professional consultants or personal service contracts. We have now, through the long and tedious task of the administrative procedures, and with the help of Mr. Bransfield, the Attorney General, and the several attorney members of our board, adopted and have promulgated the very comprehensive rules concerning the selection and appointment of architects, engineers, and related consultants. That's gone through legislative council and has been approved in compliance with 279051. It's just now accomplished formally through all this Administrative Procedures Act, which had been done on an informal basis over the years on the basis of general statutory authority. My concern is that we are better equipped to handle the professional service contract for the facilities of the Department of Higher Education, with whom we have a much closer relationship in the Board of Higher Education than could possibly the Department of General Services in this area.
Do you both agree on that?
Because the same argument can be extended to any division of state government. We have adopted similar rules for selection, architecture, and
What's the advantage of having public general consistency and centralization? Well, what about the argument, is there a balance? The argument that comes up in my mind is that Mr. Undrup is saying that they're inside, they know the program that they're dealing with. Wouldn't your obvious argument on the other side be that you would be coming in from the outside and be able to give us a fresh look?
That would be one of our arguments. Then this is the same argument used in purchasing law and the reason for centralized purchasing, that you're liable to have broader access to various professional services. You're liable to have a commonality of contract language and terms that is done centrally rather than a variety of ways. If I was sitting in Mr. Hundrum's place, I would make the exact same recommendation he was, except for me, that being a large, somewhat specialized department of the state, and probably we can do the job better. So I'm not sure.
Have either one of you made a study to show why your way of doing it is better? Or
when you're dealing with a personal or professional service, you're dealing with a topic much different than something that can be bid competitively. When you're dealing with purchasing, you're dealing generally in the area of items which have an opportunity to go out in a bid invitation basis. That's not true with medical services or legal services or architectural or engineering services. We do not bid professional services.
Most professions are prohibited by the rules of their professional organizations from bidding for a job. In the sake of writing down a closed bid and all that sort of thing. These are competitive fields.
It would be maybe helpful to you, and I'll be less glad to leave with the committee a copy of our administrative rule of the Board of Education for the selection process, where screening committees are set up, interviews take place, recommendations are formulated, and then when the decision is made as to the priority in effect of their choice, then the matter of negotiation of a contract comes into play. In order to arrive at a satisfactory compensation and other features of the contract. And I write a great many of these contracts, and what you do for one assignment may be very basically different than what you would do for another assignment. For instance, if you're merely needing some consultation advice for a master campus planning update, it'd be very different than the physical design of a multimillion-dollar chemistry building or Residence Hall or Married Student Housing or whatever it may be, or a vessel, this kind of
thing. Senator, you asked the question of any study had ever been done in this area. Has anybody ever come before you and tell you say, no, one method is better than the other in this area? And they suggest you guard your wallet as well as your mind, because real facts, hard facts in this area are just rare as snowflakes. Notice that both of us say we think, we believe. I don't know, I would not know how to conduct a meaningful study. We operate on the theory it's easy to prove in purchasing when you can compare dollars in place. We operate on the theory of centralized review of personal service contracts, just like it makes an uniformity. Broader number of people in the files to research them and the like, but that's a belief, and not knowledge. I'm sorry, I can't tell you that I have a hard study, but I don't.
Knowledge is a belief.
But you're basically on page 3 and line 3 and 4, continuing the jurisdiction in this particular area in the Department of Higher Education.
For academic
physical facilities.
Yeah, for academic.
And that is that a in the spirit of compromise, or is that because without any conviction that they have superior abilities?
Trying to think about an answer that is honest. laboratory facility. These are things that are so specialized. They're a lot like bridges, and like the expertise exists out in the unit. On the other hand, we have paving contracts, general architectural contracts, and the like, but there's no body specialized expertise out in the agency that needs to be bound. The same reason we leave liquor and textbooks alone. These people have very specialized expertise, and we have no desire to try to duplicate it. But for instance, I don't think there's any expertise in the university on the bidding of the repaving or the laying of the sewer line or that sort of thing. I think there is expertise in designing classrooms and laboratory facilities and other related academic work. The problem comes when you get something that drops right in the middle between the two. I think in the past what we've done is jawbone.
What's the personal service contract? Would that include hiring faculty?
No. Is that a personal service contract?
Not in the context as it is now, Madam Chairman. The statutes assigned to the executive department the responsibility for all personal service contracts other than architectural and engineering. That's in the statute. The General Services Department may, upon the request of a state agency or the constitutional officer, the word is may, not shall, arrange for such professional services. The section that you're dealing with in Senate Bill 136 relates to that particular section, which now the Department of General Services proposes to make mandatory for all agencies rather than permissive. And our proposal is to continue the exemption for all facilities of the Department of Higher Education.
And it is that definition the Department of Transportation is concerned about the way and I agree with that.
I would also call to your attention, your counsel and Valerie will have it available to her, that the Attorney General reviewed this question in 1976 in relation to a request from the military department as to whether, in effect, the Department of General Services had to perform this service or whether the Department of Military could do it on its own. And the response was that each agency had the opportunity because the permissive language was there rather than the mandatory language. But the proposal here is to change that from permissive to mandatory. It is our concern that insofar as programs and projects, campus planning, whatever it may be for the institutions of the state system of higher education be continued as a responsibility of the Board of Higher Education and its staff rather than the Department of General Services.
Further questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you very much.
Boyd?
I am, Madam Chairman and members of the committee, I am J.B. Boyd, right-of-way engineer for the State Highway Division. We were concerned in several areas in this particular bill this morning, and we met with Mr. Sprecher, and it does transfer some of the responsibilities that we presently have to the Executive Department to the Department of General Services, and some of the references in the law are a little unclear. And we have talked out here in the outer corridor and believe that if we would be given some time to define some of these areas, such as the personal service contract, and to prevent conflicts with our responsibilities in the Department of Transportation insofar as the expeditious handling of our work, Mr. Sprecher, in the areas that we discussed this morning, believes that we can solve all our problems, and it does not seem to be a particular problem. We have what we believe are personal service contracts, such as hiring fee appraisers. We have to do this fairly rapidly. We have to do it, in an expeditious manner in order to accomplish our program. We think we can adhere to this, but this earlier, this after we met,
We did meet with the state highway engineer, and there are some questions as to what public works contract means, what personal service contract means, some other areas of this which may relate to whether we can get our job done in the proper order and the proper time frame. So we can do this in the next week, but we would appreciate your indulgence.
Now I'm wondering, would this authorize that? Is there anything in there that would authorize
the personal service contract between our? I know nothing of what you're saying. Hypothetically, I hope.
Yeah, could you hire Hughes and Davis, for example, to go and lobby for the highway department?
I have no knowledge. I would have to refer that to our attorney. I do know that oftentimes when you ask the question of personal service contract, some elements of government, I believe probably up in the city of Beaverton, they did hire certain people under personal service contracts for specific jobs. They're all managed jobs, I see.
I'd certainly be perfectly willing to exempt that from the purview of general service. I'd be glad to leave that to anybody else.
Now, this bill, I'm sorry, I either wasn't here or I wasn't listening, or maybe both. But what does this bill do? Would you summarize it in about one line for me?
For me, it changes our responsibility slightly under and puts a question in ORS 366.400, which is the general charge to the Department of Transportation. It gives us certain words, and it speaks broadly to contracts of the Department of Transportation relating to the construction, maintenance, operation, improvement, or betterment of highways, bridges, and parks. This speaks to the public works contracts of the Department of Transportation relating to the construction or maintenance of highways, bridges, and parks.
Oh, so this would clearly give you the authority to approve or disapprove of these other agency contracts? That's the objective?
That is now voluntary. It would make it mandatory in two classes. One is public works projects, and the other is in the field of professional and personal service contracts relating to architectural engineering and related services.
Why don't we add lobby to put in there? Have you review any contract by any state agency that proposes to hire a lobbyist?
The legislature may do whatever it wishes, and I will carry out its wish.
The only thing in this area that, and I don't think Mr. Sprecher intended to get into the problems of
Susan.
I do not. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that there's just a problem in the definition of how far these things were supposed to go as far as our responsibilities to operate and maintain the highway system. Those directly related to that. When we go to presently, we answer to the executive department on any personal service contracts we make with the area fee appraisers, for instance. And we ask their permission on anyone that goes over $2,500. This transfers that responsibility to Mr. Sprecher and his group, and we have no, as long as we've got a telephone and are able to execute our work, well, we have no.
Well, and to give you an example of what we've already worked out, rather than try to place them, they have a problem with the expert witness. If you need them like that, we have the power to delegate the responsibility for purchasing in any area, probably as relates to that, we would delegate it to them. I told them this morning we'll send them a letter delegating rather than try to work a very narrow. public works relating to highways, bridges, and parks we don't want within 1,000 miles.
All right, so the idea here is the General Service Agency is kind of a police contract. And I think that's good. And that's why I think there is a growing tendency of public agencies in this state to hire private lobbies, which I happen to think is an unmitigated evil, almost unmitigated evil. So I think it would be a good idea for you to have the right to review any such contract between any one of the state agencies that proposes to hire a separate lobbyist.
Well, we ought to throw an advertising firm, too.
What about Steve Brown?
As long as you will give us the budget instruction, budget notes, so that we will know what standards we to apply, we'll administer any law you like.
Is there a prohibition against lobbyists go to state parties?
My proposed bill is going to provide that there must be a review by the Ethics Commission, not to prohibit it, but it, to determine whether or not there's conflict of interest. And one of the obvious other accounts. So for this would not say that you couldn't, you know, like the city of Portland hired Mark Kelly full time. That's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But my concern is you've got lobbyist A over here represents a public agency. He also represents someone that sells stuff to public agencies. And he also represents ABC, all these, Ken Linky and the tobacco industry, and God knows what. I know what lobbyists do, how they work. You know, I think that's bad.
Who drafted the bill?
Interesting question. On staff and the Constitution State of Tennessee, I don't know if they drafted it themselves or if they got it or anything. Sure, if you know, tell them. I don't.
That is one of our concerns. when we tried to verify this with and started to question some of the references, why we do not believe it was done by one of the attorneys general. We normally have our bills drafted and then sent, of course, to the legislative council office by our attorney general. And we don't think that this had the blessing of an attorney, I hate to say.
That's
the reference that I make.
So in our organization,
all your bills, please, and find out who drafted them.
Certainly. We can add that. I will see that that's added in the future on the summary. We, in my organization, my executive assistant is responsible for coordination of legislative proposals. I do not do them myself. That's why I have got this. Whether they all were or not, I don't know. We'll note that in the future on our summary, who did the actual draft.
And that's our main concern, is with the definitions and the various things don't accidentally get into some area that's going to severely thwart our efforts to get our job done.
On our summaries, is there any other information the committee would like other than what we've furnished now? We're going to try to provide these with all our bills, and you're the first committee we can support. That will help you look down to see if it was drafted by the administrator of the purchasing division or by deputy attorney general. So and so will help you a lot.
Well, that's good. Whether or not they live up to their reputation, it's generally been taken by legislators that they do a lot better about bills that have been cleared with legislative council, which is a separate kind of group that works. Well, the legislative branch of government and has not only the obligation to draft bills for the legislature, but to take a look at agency bills, and also after the session is over to place them properly and we will then put them back in for it. A lot of people feel a lot better about legislation that is cleared legislative council. So maybe in the future. future when we have bills, we might think of that, because that's one of the things that eases many people's minds about how bills are worded, compiled, etc.
I think that all of our bills have, and I see an awful lot of the LCs coming back, but I can't state as a matter of fact before you get time, I do know that a majority of our bills came back from the Legislative Council. I'll simply tell my people that all of them will be at the Legislative Council. I have them the next time I'm before you. I'll let you know whether they have it. I thought they all did, but that's again the difference between belief and knowledge. I'll let knowledge have.
In general, in dealing with contacts generally, what is the authority of various agencies? And this seems to have just a limited area of contact, must be cleared by you. What's the practice in other kinds of contacts that might be entered into by various state agencies?
Well, the exception of these very large contracts, we approve many construction contracts, and permissibly many personal service contracts. We have nothing against various work on contracts with construction highways.
Like when the Department of Transportation hires lobbyists, they don't have to, I don't mean lobbyists, I mean advertising.
They do not have to come to us.
They don't have to come.
We have no expertise in that.
Neither do they, maybe, but then Senator Orion, maybe they do. Is there no one can check what is the practice? Each department does all of its own things, enters into all of its own contracts.
The Department of Transportation, of course, does in any of the fields that we normally operate in, which are the operation, construction, maintenance, the area that I...
When they hire these people to handle an advertising program to encourage people to come to Oregon for tourism, who approves that?
Sorry, I have to... The right-of-way engineer that is not, or if the construction engineer is not in my area of knowledge.
Department of Transportation.
Mr. Hunderup.
Statute prescribes that all personal service contracts must be cleared by the executive department, other than those for architectural and engineering programs. This bill deals with architectural and engineering services. Your question about lobbyists, but I think more appropriately would be that you need approval to the executive department for all agencies.
All right, so the Department of Commerce could not, if it wanted to enter into a contract to have someone go to Washington, D.C. and lobby for them, they would have to have that contract cleared through the Executive Department.
The personal service contracts that we've had in the past for other architectural and engineering services, we have had consultants in the field for handling.
I misunderstood you, and that's what I was saying with the appraisal services. We go directly to the Executive Department for their approval on anything that's over $2,500. Less than $2,500, we furnish them a report. We also furnish to the Department of General Services a copy of the final documents, which we pay off the services. So there's a check with the Executive Department. They also check the after the fact thing, however, it passes to them on any action that we take within my area of responsibility. When we get into the other area, I am not familiar with.
Okay, that clears up some questions in my mind.
One thing, I don't have a copy of 136, but while Senator Cook was out of the room, it seemed to me that the impression I got of the testimony was that the General Services Department is trying to move in a little bit on the Department of Higher Education on being able to approve these personal service contracts on buildings that were not clearly academic without either agency having total agreement about what the word academic meant. But buildings that were away from the campus, like an experiment station or
don't want to be an extra pig barn. Might not be an academic building, and the general service department would like to be able to review those contracts, and the Department of Higher Education would rather not have them. It turned out to be a fascinating discussion, but it leaves me without any more idea about which way it should go than when we started. And I would really like to, when I vote, not today, but when I, by the time I vote, I would feel a lot better to me if I was voting out of some feeling that I had an idea of whether that I was bettering.
And I
would like
you
to get some more done.
Perhaps we should ask the executive department to testify. If they have expertise in the personal service contract area overall, then Senator Cook could ask some of those interesting questions he's been taking up on lobbyists. Perhaps they're the appropriate neutral third party. As I said, this is not a raging war between the two of you, well. But generally speaking, I think they take a slightly different definition of their world than we do.
Why don't you take a try at trying to work it out between
the two? I have a suggestion of compromise, which is they take everything inside the boundaries of campus, and I'll take everything outside.
That didn't bring the smile to Mr. Hudrow's face.
Any intrusion upon higher education does not bring any smile to his face because he has to go back and report it.
Senator Brown.
For the benefit of the record, Mr. Hudrow, my basic information is, as the years pass, we feel that people in the academic community do not have any special expertise in academic buildings. Professional librarian who was part of law school. The library there is an unmitigated disaster. And
is that since you've been there? Or
no,
you
know, it was that way when I arrived. And I think painfully about the science library at the University of Oregon, which was immediately flooded after it was opened because the drains went across the proper size. And the tile in the foyer of the law school where any civil liability lawyer would shudder because of the possibility of falls, electric shocks in the rugs inside the library. But on the other hand, for the benefit of Mr.
Sprecher,
I had a constituent call me about 2 or 3 months ago about a bid that had been issued by Egypt folks for a laundry, commercial type of washing machine for one.
Do I remember that?
For one of the social agencies here, it was a piece of equipment, the manufacturer of which was long out of business, for which no spare parts were available. And apparently, a gentleman who I won't identify, who's a bit of a charlatan, had one. He sold one to a school in a nearby town. It had never operated, and then 2 years they held it. We folks went out of bid for these pieces of equipment for which no spare parts were available.
We loused that up considerably. And when you were talking about the problems at the library, I was thinking about some of the leaky roofs and some of the floor tiles and some of the buildings where the highly expertise Department of General Services was in fact the primary cure.
We have to vote yes or no.
Well, you probably vote on the basis that you agree to foul it up the least, because I have to tell you, we have made some horrendous errors, too. And the washing machine, I definitely remember. I spent some time discussing that with the people involved.
Further questions?